From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Grammy Award-winning record producer Daniel Lanois. He produced Bob Dylan's new album, Oh Mercy, as well as records by the Neville Brothers, U2, and Peter Gabriel. Now he has his own record of his own songs to add to his credits. Also today, Robert Mondavi tells us how he helped lead the California wine industry into creating premium wines. Rock historian Ed Ward takes a fresh look at the late Louis Jordan, and book critic John Leonard reviews The Fur Hat by Soviet writer Vladimir Voinovich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. The Czechoslovak government decided today to abolish the Communist Party's political monopoly in a move capping 11 days of protests and strikes. The decision was taken in consultation with the new party leadership and opposition leaders. Prime Minister Ladislav Adamitz also promised the government will include non-communist ministers. West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl today proposed a confederation between East and West Germany with some common parliamentary and government institutions. There was a positive reaction in West Germany to the proposal, but considerable skepticism in East Germany. Deidre Berger reports.
Chancellor Helmut Kohl's proposal means close government cooperation between East and West Germany, with the eventual goal of German unity. Wolfgang Mayer, spokesman for the East German government, said the plan had some interesting aspects, but it evaded the East-West security issues raised by the prospects of deeper cooperation. East German opposition leader Ibrahim Böhme of the newly founded Social Democratic Party said it is too early to rush into confederation. Other East German opposition figures also expressed concern the proposal could block the development of political alternatives in East Germany. In East Berlin today, 30 prominent artists and academics issued a statement calling for the preservation of East German sovereignty. The group said East Germany must remain a socialist alternative to a capitalist West Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger.
One of El Salvador's leading politicians and jurists was gunned down in a main street in the capital today. Former Supreme Court Justice Jose Francisco Guerrero was shot in the throat when four attackers fired on his car. A spokesman for the Salvadoran Armed Forces said the attack was the work of leftist guerrillas. As David Adams reports from El Salvador, no one so far has claimed responsibility for the attack.
Francisco Jose Guerrero's car was riddled with bullets as he rode down a main street in the center of the capital, accompanied by two bodyguards. Police said one of four attackers was killed. His body, dressed in civilian clothes, lay by the side of the road with a pair of sunglasses clipped to his belt. Four bullets hit the front windscreen of the car. The side windows were also shot out. Both bodyguards apparently escaped unhurt. The government accused El Salvador's left-wing guerrillas of responsibility for the attack. Vice President Francisco Marino called the gunmen beasts who should be treated as such. But so far, the guerrillas have made no comment on the killing. Guerrero, who was 64, was regarded as one of the country's most cunning right-wing politicians. Since leaving his post as Supreme Court Justice in May, he served as a special advisor to President Alfredo Cristiani. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in San Salvador.
A crane fell from a 16-story building under construction today in San Francisco. At least five people are dead, 21 are hurt. You're listening to National Public Radio News. The environmental group Greenpeace today promised to mount a high seas protest Friday when the organization says the Navy plans to test fire an unarmed Trident II missile from a submarine off the coast of Florida. Greenpeace spokeswoman Shannon Fagan said activists aboard a 190-foot motor vessel and a 60-foot sailboat would protest a launch attempt by entering a launch in the danger zone and deploying inflatable rafts. The same two vessels entered the launch danger zone for a test in July and forced the Navy to delay the missile's second test firing. A state district court judge in Dallas has been publicly censured for comments suggesting he may have given a lighter sentence to an execution-style killer because his two victims were homosexuals. Tom Olson of member station KERA reports.
The Texas Commission on Judicial Conduct censured Judge Jack Hampton for discussing a pending case with reporters and found his comments were destructive to public confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary. Following a murder trial last year, Judge Hampton told reporters that, quote, he didn't much care for queers cruising the streets and that some murder victims are less innocent in their deaths. The censure has no tangible impact on the judge, but Dallas Gay Alliance President William Wayburn hopes voters of conscience will oust Hampton next election.
It's not up to the gay and lesbian community to get rid of this judge. It's up to the society at large. As long as Judge Hampton sits on the bench, there is no justice.
The Republican judge declined comment, but has already announced he'll seek re-election next year. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Olson in Dallas.
Federal banking regulators have begun foreclosure proceedings on an office building owned by former Arizona Governor Evan Meekum, who uses the building as his headquarters. Meekum owes nearly $462,000 on a mortgage he took out in 1985. He has until February 23rd to work out an agreement with the FDIC. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Daniel Lanois has emerged as one of the more interesting rock record producers of the late 1980s. His credits include the U2 albums The Joshua Tree and Unforgettable Fire, Peter Gabriel's So, Robbie Robertson's recent self-titled album, the Neville Brothers' latest, Yellow Moon, and Bob Dylan's new album, Oh Mercy, which has been described by many critics as Dylan's best album in years. Lanois learned a lot about synthesizers and electronic production techniques, working with composer and producer Brian Eno. Daniel Lanois grew up in Hull, in the French-speaking northeastern spur of Canada. He didn't learn to speak English until his family moved to Hamilton, Ontario, when he was 11. For the past couple of years, Lanois has worked out of a studio in New Orleans, a city that was settled by the French Acadians when they were expelled from Canada in the mid-1700s. Now Lanois has a new record of his own, his first album of his own songs. After creating a sound for so many other performers, I wanted to know how he came up with the sound for his own record, Acadie.
I did give that some thought, but some of the songs on the record are quite clear in their own direction. You know, they didn't need a lot of preconception or direction. You know, like a song like Jolie Louise, a melody like da 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 da. You know, it sort of creates its own path. You know, there's only so much you can do with a little tune like that.
Now let me ask you about your song, The Maker. This is, you say in the liner notes of the record that the song was superimposed on a drum track that was recorded for the Neville Brothers record, but this drum track wasn't used on that record, so you asked for permission to use it on the song. What was it about the drum track that made you want to take it back?
I really love these New Orleans rhythms, and Willie Green, the drummer who played that, is like one of the best drummers in New Orleans. And he had played this track for the song Voodoo on the Yellow Moon record, but we had chosen a different approach, and the track was never used, but it was always like the best drum track in a way. And isolated like from the song Voodoo, it just had this fantastic skipping, uplifting feeling. And I had hoped that someday I'd find a home for that track, and I kept it on the shelf. And I think I tried quite a few of my songs against that drum track just to desperately make it work.
But The Maker fit?
The Maker was most successful.
This record is four mixes done at four different times?
Yeah. It's
edited together?
It's a technique that I use. I don't use computers for mixing, so what I will do is do a mix on a given day and document all the settings with a camera. And then if the mix needs to be changed, like let's say it's a great mix but the intro is not quite right, Well, you can put up the same mix by using a recall on the camera and remix just an intro and cut it together, like with a razor blade on tape. And then a few days later, I might think, well, maybe the ending can be better. So it's a series of remixes spliced together on analog tape.
Is it hard to get a spontaneous feel to a record when there are so many mixes and so much editing involved?
Well, spontaneity is the reason why you do that, because maybe that first mix was a spontaneous mix and something was captured. And rather than junk it, I choose to repair it, you know, to do little cuts and incisions and to save, you know, that wonderful spontaneous foundation.
Now, I think the Maker is an interesting contrast to your song Jolie Louise, which is...
I can help you with it.
Okay, yeah.
They're very different in the sense that Jolie Louise has a traditional sounding melody. It's very underproduced, you know. It has maybe four components, you know, an accordion, a couple of guitars, drums and bass. And it has sort of a timelessness because of it. The story is sort of timeless, and the approach is too. Now, The Maker, on the other hand, is quite modern in its production, anyhow. Very much unlike Jolie Louise.
Now, Jolie Louise sounds like all the musicians were together in the studio playing, which, of course, they weren't.
No, it ended up sounding like that, luckily. But it should sound that way, you know, for that song. That track was initially laid down with my doing knee slap, which is just this kind of hand percussion on your lap, and Malcolm Byrne playing Wurlitzer piano, and a little time reference, like a little pulse. And the vocal was done live with the piano to this little pulse. And it always had like this really sweet and sour feeling to it that we managed to maintain throughout, like a very happy melody with a very sad song. Ma jolie, how do you do? Mon nom est Jean-Guy Thibault-Leroux. I come from east of Gatineau. My name is Jean-Guy, ma jolie. J'ai une maison à La Fontaine, where we can live if you marry me. Une belle maison à La Fontaine, where we will live, you and me. Oh, Louise, oh, ma jolie Louise. Tous les matins au soleil, I will work till work is done. Tous les matins au soleil, I did work till work is done. And one day, the foreman said, Jean-Guy, we must let you go. Et puis mon nom est pas bon at the mill anymore. Oh, Louise, I'm losing my head, I'm losing my head. My kids are small, 4 and 3. Et la bouteille, she's mon ami.
I like the way the lines alternate between English and French. I was wondering if that's the way you think sometimes, having grown up in French-speaking Quebec and then moving at 10 or 11 to English-speaking Ontario. Do you still think a little in English, a little in French?
Well, even these days, I think in French. My months are in French, and I count in French. But it's also the way people speak in certain parts of Canada, you know, where, like between Ontario and Quebec, where these little communities, it's not quite defined whether they're French or English, and there's this kind of mixture, you know, and people will start speaking in French and then change into English to accommodate certain words.
You've been working out of New Orleans for the past few years, and I was wondering if being in a culture that is derived in part from French-speaking Canadians who emigrated down to New Orleans, if that's given you a new perspective on the French part of your background, both musically and culturally.
I was always interested in that migration, you know, the Acadians leaving the North and going to Louisiana. It's a fascinating story. But my visit to New Orleans was quite an innocent one. I was really it was more of a musical adventure. I wanted to understand about the beats in that part of the world. But so there was not, a great Acadian connection for me. That's not why I went there. In fact, you have to go west to really be exposed to the Cajun culture. It's in Lafayette rather than New Orleans.
Well, in New Orleans, you produced one of the best known New Orleans groups, the Neville Brothers. I was wondering how you try to maintain a balance of their sound, their almost jamming kind of sound, and your more, I think, kind of controlled approach to production.
I was really looking to maintain a good balance. For me, like, one of the best records the Neville Brothers ever did is the Wild Chapatulas record, if you're familiar with that. It's quite a traditional record, Their Uncle Jolly pushed them to make that record, and it's fantastic. And I thought if we could make a record as great as the Wild Chapatulas record, it would be quite a feat. As it turns out, we did not do a traditional record. The Neville Brothers are just not that interested in the traditional music anymore. They love it and everything, but they're just not doing that thing anymore. So we had to find a new exciting angle, a new direction. So we tried all sorts of techniques. I found that much of the arrangements that they had did not work so well in the studio, because it's a thing that in the excitement of a live performance, like these quite long-winded arrangements work. But you get into the studio and you're presented with a few cliches that you must knock down. So we had to quite radically take some new approaches for songs like My Blood. And it was important for me to find a new twist on that so that it didn't sound like a cliche.
And what was the twist you found?
I suggested that they build their song on top of a track that I already had in the library, something that Brian Eno and I started a long time ago. It was 7 years old, this track, and it happened to be the same rhythm, the same pulse as My Blood. And it had this quite beautiful, ethereal atmosphere. In the same key. So I suggested build a song around this because it will take you to someplace unknown.
Neville Brothers performing My Blood from their latest album, Yellow Moon. The album was produced by my guest, Daniel Lanois. We'll talk with Daniel Lanois about producing Bob Dylan's latest record after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio. Thank you.
Record producer, songwriter, and singer Daniel Lenoir is my guest.
You produced Bob Dylan's latest record. How did you prepare for working with him? Did you go back and listen to his other records again to get a sense of where he'd been up until this point and where the next step might be?
There are so many Bob Dylan records that it would take a year to to become an expert on them. I chose to listen to two or three records of his. There's one of his albums is called Desire, one of my faves. Also, his first record, which I think is just called Bob Dylan, has some amazing songs on it. And I like the freedom of the guitar playing on that record. You know, it breaks in and out of time, you know, almost randomly to accommodate the lyrics and the vocal performance. So I guess I looked to those records as landmarks, but I was not so interested in studying his more recent records. You know, I had heard rumors that they were not as special as some of his previous recordings, so I didn't want to be pulled down in any way. I wanted to remain optimistic and look to the greatest work as a standard.
Now, I want to play the track most of the time, and I feel like I can hear your production on this. Tell me about what you were doing on this song.
Most of the time, Bob played me that song on piano, just him on piano and singing it. I paid him a visit at his house, and I recorded a version of that in that simplicity, and I lived with that simple rendition of it for so long that I was very attached to it, and I fell in love with the phrasing of that rendition, and I really wanted quite specifically to repeat that, you know, and not have too much around it. So it's essentially the same vocal approach, but in the end I decided to undermine it with these strange distorted distant guitars, you know, like almost like like a Sweet and Sour thing again, because the song is saying, like, most of the time I'm clear focused all around, most of the time I can keep both feet on the ground. It's like you've said all of these things, how confident you are, but then, you know, at a moment of weakness, you think about the person that you really need. And I really want to somehow make that weakness evident in the distance.
Most of the time I'm clear focused all around, most of the time I can keep both feet on the ground. I can follow the path, I can read the sign, stay right with it when the road unwinds. I can handle whatever I stumble upon. I don't even notice the sea gone most of the time.
Dylan has a rough voice. It's not a polished voice. Is there a different way you'd produce someone like that than you would someone who has, you know, like, you know, perfect pitch and, you know, a beautiful voice?
The best way to deal with a rough voice is to make it rough and to put it in the foreground. And that's what I tried to do on this Bob Dylan record. His voice is not tucked under the rug, you know. It's like in your face. You can hear the whiskiness of it, the breathing, all the words. I like that in his voice, and I think it comes through in the record.
You started off when you were living in Canada, with a production facility in your basement that I think you and your brother built. And that's where you met Brian Eno, who did some production work there. What brought him there?
The studio started out really small. It was like, it was nothing. It was like in the recreation room of my mother's house. And we hit like every step of the ladder, you know, the two-track, four-track, eight-track. And whenever we had any kind of cash, you know, from work, we would just sink it right back into equipment. And eventually we moved out of the basement and started this pretty nice studio called Grant Avenue Studio. It was like a family-run restaurant, you know. And we did a lot of productions in there, and one of those productions made its way to New York. These people called the Time Twins brought a tape to Brian Eno and played him this tape. And he was really blown away by the strangeness of the approach. And he said, who made this tape? You know? And they said, well, there's this Canadian guy that you might like to work with. And so Brian phoned up and just booked time out of the blue. It's quite an innocent little tale, you know.
I want to end with the last track from your new record. And this is a version of Amazing Grace, sung by Aaron Neville of the Neville Brothers. I guess it's something he recorded for the Neville Brothers record that you produced. Why wasn't the track used on their record?
I was doing some demos with the Neville Brothers, and we tried a lot of things. You know, we tried Listening Wind by the Talking Heads, which is a great song. Never got used. We tried Amazing Grace, a dozen different things. And Amazing Grace was always a staggering performance, and it was almost a cappella. Art was holding organ chords down, but they were more like for pitch reference. And Aaron was in the other corner of the room singing this Amazing Grace. And it brought tears to my eyes when I heard this. And I thought, we must use this somewhere. But the Neville's record was already a little bit weighed down at the quiet end, so it would have put it off balance. So we chose to leave it off, and I started experimenting with this Amazing Grace, thinking that I might use it on my record. And I like the strange and interesting rendition that we have. It's like Amazing Grace being sung in the future.
Well, there's a lot of interesting electronic effects here that I think you couldn't have used on a Neville Brothers record. It isn't their sound at all. It's your sound.
It would have been too ethereal, I think, for them, not representative of what they do.
And this is one of the times when you have Neville mixed in the background. You know, it sounds very distant, the vocal.
Yeah, it just worked best that way. When I mix his vocal far away, it sounded like somebody trying to reach you, trying to communicate a message, but from a place very far away, and almost like they're rediscovering this ancient folk song and singing it for the first time. And sounds like it's coming through a shortwave radio.
Great. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Daniel Lanois, his new album Acadie is on Warner Brothers Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. From Daniel Lanois' new album, this is Aaron Neville singing Amazing Grace.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. California wine used to be synonymous with jug wine. Coming up, we meet Robert Mondavi, one of the California vintners who created premium California wines and turned around the image of the Napa Valley. Also, rock historian Ed Ward reacquaints us with one of the forgotten pioneers of rhythm and blues, saxophonist and singer Louis Jordan. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Fur Hat, a novel by Soviet writer Vladimir Voinovich. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that there will be no deals made and no surprises at his summit meeting with Soviet leader Gorbachev. Calling reporters to the Oval Office today, the president said once again that there is no set agenda for the meeting this weekend. Mr. Bush said that there are some issues that he considers important, such as Soviet aid for Cuban leader Fidel Castro. The president also said that he resented what he called hype speculation, that the meeting is going to be different from Get Acquainted talks. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has told NATO defense ministers that the U.S. will not pull troops out of Europe without first consulting the Allies. Harold Briley, the BBC, has more on NATO's first meeting since the opening of the Berlin Wall.
The main theme of the defense ministers' meeting has been NATO's determination to maintain stability and strong Western defenses in a situation of such unpredictability. The European defense ministers emerged saying they've been reassured by the United States that reports of steep future cuts in its armed forces are far in the future. Mr. Cheney reaffirmed Washington's commitment to continue playing a full part in the defense of West Europe. He told them no cuts would be agreed unilaterally with the Soviet Union. There'll be full consultation with all the NATO allies to promote East-West agreement in Vienna, securing significant reductions in conventional forces on both sides.
Harold Briley, the BBC. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark said today that he hopes to travel to El Salvador to represent an American woman who was detained after police found a large stash of arms under her house. Jennifer Casolo, a church worker from Seattle, Washington, is still being held by officials in El Salvador. Washington State Congressman Jim McDermott has just returned from that Central American country, where he met with a U.S. citizen. Ann Martin of member station KPLU in Seattle reports.
Congressman McDermott says the Salvadoran authorities told him charges would be brought against Casolo within 24 hours. McDermott, who knew Casolo before this incident, says he finds the whole thing hard to believe, although he does say El Salvador is not a good place for foreigners to be if they are involved in any sort of humanitarian efforts.
I think there's a pattern of things that are happening which would suggest that the government of El Salvador at the moment underestimates the strength of the resistance of the rebels. And they want to believe that it's being created by outside forces rather than something that's indigenous and grassroots oriented.
Congressman McDermott describes the situation in El Salvador as chaotic. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Martin in Seattle.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 7 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Most people think rhythm and blues is an invention of the post-war era, something that originated with musicians like Ray Charles and Roy Brown and the early doo-wop groups. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of one of the true pioneers of R&B.
It's an all-too-familiar irony. Here's one of America's most influential musicians, but none of his records are in print in this country. And when I mentioned his name to an otherwise well-informed person the other day, the reaction I got was, "Who?" Yet Louis Jordan, a short, alto saxophone-playing black man with a goofy smile and a natural gift for comedy, can, I think, be said to have invented rhythm and blues, to have been one of the first black artists to sell as well with whites as with blacks, and to have been directly responsible for inspiring rock and roll by giving Chuck Berry something to aim at. Louis Jordan was born on July 8, 1908, in Brinkley, Arkansas, and first shows up in the reference books as a member of Chick Webb's popular band in the mid-30s. He made his first recordings in 1939, and the next year he recorded the first one in his inimitable style.
You cats keep beating up your chops. I ought to turn you over to the cops. But dig this field, I'm gonna lay on your gate. Don't cop your broom, park the body and wait. You run your mouth and I run my business, brother. You run your mouth and I run my business, brother. You tell everybody I'm busted. You talk so much you got me disgusted. But you run your mouth and I run my business, brother.
All that hip jive talk went over well with jazz fans, and his band, called the Timpani Five, although there were usually seven or eight of them, none of whom played timpani, laid down a rhythm everybody could dance to. Jordan's records quickly sold well enough that he was one of the few artists who recorded commercially during the Second World War, and one of the few black artists who had a major label deal with Decca. But after the war, Louis Jordan's career really took off.
Heading for the station with a pack on my back. I'm tired of transportation in the back of a hack. I love to hear the rhythm of the clickety-clack and hear the lonesome whistle, see the smoke from the stack and pal around with Democratic fellas named Mac. So take me right back to the track, Jack. Choo-choo, choo-choo, jaboogie. Woo-woo, woo-woo, jaboogie. Choo-choo, choo-choo, jaboogie. Take me right back to the track, Jack.
Choo Choo Chaboogie was Jordan's second million-selling record, and it decimated the charts in 1946. His most famous record, though, had come out a year earlier and hadn't sold as well because dozens of other artists recorded it at about the same time in imitation of the Jordan magic.
Walking with my baby, she got great big feet. She long, lean, and lank, and ain't had nothing to eat. But she's my baby, and I love her just the same. Crazy about that woman, cause Caledonia is her name. Caledonia! Caledonia! I want to make your big head so hot, Ma. I love you just the same. I'll always love you, baby, cause Caledonia is your name.
Caledonia, as an expression of dismay or exasperation, entered the language in black communities right away. And 20 years later, I heard a black teenager put down another's antiquated taste by calling it Caledonia-fied. Jordan was hot. He made a record with Bing Crosby. He made another one with Ella Fitzgerald. And hot on the heels of Caledonia, he made another record whose title wound up on everybody's lips.
One night, Farmer Brown was taking the air, locked up the barnyard with the greatest of care. Down in the hen house, something stirred when he shouted, "Who's there?" This is what he heard. There ain't nobody here but us chickens. There ain't nobody here at all. So calm yourself and stop that fuss. There ain't nobody here but us. We chickens trying to sleep, and you butt in and hobble, 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 hobble with your chin.
Now, with a record like this, Jordan was skating on thin ice. On the one hand, Farmer Brown being told to mind his own business by a voice from the hen house is a pretty funny story. On the other, this is yet another stereotype tale of black people stealing chickens because the stereotype says they're too lazy to work. The good humor, I think, overwhelms the dark side of the song. After all, there's no evidence of the chicken thief's race. But in the years ahead, as black self-image became an issue, Jordan's stock would fall. And there's no doubt that his stories, as epitomized in this 1949 smash hit, were of an earlier era.
Now, if you ever been down to New Orleans, then you can understand just what I mean. Now, all through the week it's quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house. You don't have to pay the usual admission if you're a cook or a waiter or a good musician. So if you happen to be just passing by, stop in at the Saturday night fish fry. It was rocking. It was rocking. You never seen such scuffling and shuffling till the break of dawn.
But during this time, probably because Jordan was, like Louis Armstrong, a safe sort of black entertainer, he was the highest-grossing black act in the country and one of the highest-grossing of all. His small combo pointed the way to the modern rhythm and blues band, and his unusual humorous slice-of-life songs, delivered in rapid-fire patter, got Chuck Berry thinking about writing some himself. Louis Jordan died in 1975 of a heart attack, just as a new generation was rediscovering his genius and realizing that this funny little man might just have been the grandfather of rhythm and blues.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Baron Philippe de Rothschild once said, California wines are like Coca-Cola. They all taste the same. That was in the early 70s, but the taste and image of California wines have changed dramatically in recent years, and Robert Mondavi is one of the winemakers most responsible for the change. Mondavi's adoption of European winemaking techniques was groundbreaking in the early 60s, opening the way for the production of world-class wine in California. And through innovative marketing strategies like blind taste tests, Mondavi helped convince wine drinkers around the world that California wines could be as good as those from Europe. I asked Robert Mondavi why California specialized for so long in cheap, sweet jug wines.
We did not have as many of the fine varieties such as Cabernet, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and we were not aware of these fine varieties at that time as much as we are today. We knew that they produced very fine wines in Europe, and particularly France, but frankly, we didn't think we were in a position to compete with them at that time. And not only that, but also at that time, there wasn't enough money to go into the fine wine business. It was a rich man's hobby to go into the fine wine business. So actually, the jug wine business was something that you could make some money. And in fact, when we went into the jug business, it was to be able to pay us to go into the fine wine business. So it was the jug wine business that allowed us to really go into the fine wine business.
What made you think that the California wine industry could put out premium wines?
Well, when I was in the beginning, I only wanted to produce fine, popular-priced wines. But when I began to taste the great wines of the world, I realized that, and I was in our business some 25 years, I realized that we had the climate, the soil, the grape varieties to produce wine belonging in the world's finest. But I did realize that they were doing something in Europe that we weren't doing in our country, so I took a trip in 1962 to see what they did in winemaking. I knew we had the natural elements. There I found that they made each of their wines differently. That is, the Cabernet, the Pinot Noir were made entirely differently from one another, the Chardonnay. And what I did when I saw that, and I saw that they were aging wines in small barrels, they were doing many different things that we weren't doing, I went back and I began to do all the research work that was necessary to prove to me what would be the best. And and we began to make our wines individually. That is, a Cabernet was made as a Cabernet, a Pinot Noir as a Pinot Noir, and a Chardonnay as a Chardonnay. Once we did that, there was distinct differences in our wine, and this helped catapult the fine wines of California and Napa Valley in the company of the world's finest.
Your family had a winery, and you broke away from the family winery in 1966 to start your own. What did you want to do differently than your family had done?
Well, I wanted to be able to do everything that was necessary. I was willing to spend much more money in buying new barrels, carrying on research work. I carried on tremendous amount of research work. In fact, we set up a small little winery within our winery, our larger winery. We set up a small little experimental winery where we made 50 to 100 gallons, and we experimented in detail. And little by little, we began to change our technique so we would do exactly what we did in the small winery. So if that helped us to produce wines of greater character, greater quality.
When you first started upgrading, your wines. Did you find that there was resistance from consumers who didn't think that California could make anything other than jug wine?
There was tremendous amount of resistance. In fact, we had people from the from the East Coast who would not want to handle wines from the fine wines of California. They wanted to only handle the wines from Europe, in other words, France, Italy, Germany. They did not consider us in the company of the fine wines of the world. But that situation over a number of years have changed. In fact, I remember when I used to sit down with people in the Midwest and the East, and I want to compare our wines with those of the first gross or second gross of Europe, the people thought I was silly. And yet I shocked them when they found out, when we would taste them blind, that our wines belonged in the company. In fact, they picked our wines up more often than they did the wines from Europe.
I'm interested in your background now. You grew up in a family that made wine. Your parents emigrated from Italy to the United States in 1910. They moved to Minnesota. You were born in 1913. And your father started shipping California grapes to Minnesota for wine. Now who made the wine? Did your father have a winery then, or was this for Italian families to make their own wine at home?
This was only for Italian families to make their own wine. In fact, I remember making wine at home. We would take rubber boots and we would stomp on the grapes in tubs and crush them and ferment them that way. In fact, my father was selected. He was the secretary of the Italian Club in Minnesota. He was selected in 1919 to go to California to buy grapes for the people of the Midwest and people in the East Coast. And he continued buying. In fact, after 4 years, he moved the family from Virginia, Minnesota, to California, because he made that his livelihood thereafter.
So you grew up in a family where wine was always being made. What was your role?
Well, not only that, but I was brought up with, as a child, I was served in teaspoons in the beginning with water, and I grew up with it.
What was your role in winemaking when you were young? Were you supposed to be stomping on the grapes or what?
No, in fact, no. That we only did during the harvest. I mean, during the crushing season, my father would make homemade wine. He'd make probably a couple of barrels of wine for our own use, and I would stomp on it. And that's all I knew about wines, except that from the time I was 13 years of age, I was able to drive a car and to go to work. We nailed boxes for my father, grape shipping boxes, and we did that since I was 13 years old until I graduated from high school.
Your family was in the wine business at the time of Prohibition. What effect did it have on the family?
We were not in the wine business during Prohibition. We were in the grape shipping business.
Ah, but after all, you were shipping grapes
to
make wine.
We were shipping grapes to families in the East Coast, the Midwest. These are mainly the Mediterranean family, the Italians, the French, the Spanish families, Italians that would buy for their home, buy grapes, and they would make homemade wine because it was legal to make wine at the home.
I see. Okay. There's a new regulation that calls for warning labels on alcoholic beverages now, warnings to pregnant women that alcohol could have a damaging effect on the fetus. I wonder what your reaction is to the warning labels.
My reaction is that they're not telling the full truth. They're only telling one side of the story. We have, yes, wine, if it's abused, is bad for you. But they don't tell you, and there are instances where it is bad. There are certain people who are allergic to wine. They should not drink it. There are people that abuse it. They should not touch it at all. But wine has many, many benefits. Wine is part of our culture, part of our religion. It's part of our way of life. And to me, I say wine is the temperate, the civilized, romantic, sacred mealtime beverage that has been recommended in the Bible. It is the liquid food that has been praised since civilization started by rulers, philosophers, physicians for life, longevity, and happiness. Now, to me, to put on the bottles only the detriment, I think it's bad, because what they should do, they should educate the people both the benefits and the detriments. We need both sides of the story. Then the American people will be able to evaluate that.
How much wine would you estimate you drink a day now?
Well, you know, that I would say that I would drink a fifth of wine a day. In fact, my wife and I will go through a bottle of wine for lunch, and we'll go through a bottle of a wine for dinner. And I'm 76 years old, and I say 76 years young because I eat well and I drink well, but I drink in moderation. Now, I can drink more than most people only because I'm accustomed, my system is accustomed to it. Others may not drink anywhere near as much as I can, and that should be the case.
You drink a lot because it's part of your research. I mean, you have to keep up with the competition. How do you?
No, because I like it.
Oh, okay.
And not only that, it goes with food. And not only that, but it helped me digest my food. It's really good for you in moderation.
Nevertheless, I'm sure part of the way you choose your wine has to do with figuring out who's making what and how it tastes, so you can keep up and know what your competitors are doing. How do you choose the wine that you're going to drink at lunch and dinner?
I pick what is considered, and what we carry on constant research work at the winery. We buy the finest wines in the world. And believe you me, we buy more wines than wholesalers do, I mean, of the better wines of the world. And we constantly taste these wines only to keep us abreast of what's going on. When I go out for dinner, I guess it's sort of a trademark of mine, wherever I go, I used to order 4 or 5 bottles of wine. Not that I would drink all those, but I would order just to taste, or 6 bottles of wine. I used to do that constantly, and I still do. Wherever I go, I order these different wines to keep me aware of what's going on constantly. Not only that, it reassures me of what we're doing, where our investment of money is going. How can you do that otherwise? So to me, I want to be up with the top vintners of the world, and there's a big change taking place today in winemaking. And if you don't keep that up, little by little, if you only do what you did in the past, you will lose your relative position because there are changes taking place in winemaking. The wines are getting to be better. The grapes are getting to be better. And you have to be alert on each and every day and what's going on.
Well, Robert Mondavi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Been a pleasure being with you.
Robert Mondavi is chairman and founder of the Robert Mondavi Winery. This is Fresh Air. Things are a little hectic in the All Things Considered newsroom, but I have a rundown of some of the stories they're covering. Deborah Amos will report on today's events in Czechoslovakia, where the Communist Party has made a major concession. They've conceded the leading role of the party, their monopoly and power in Prague. And in Bonn, West Germany, Chancellor Helmut Kohl made a speech where he spoke of building a confederacy with East Germany. I'll talk with Kohl's chief spokesman, Hans Klein, about what a confederacy really means. From Kenya, there's a report on the contamination of the blood supply and the problems that AIDS has created for the treatment of anemia. And from San Francisco, more about the collapse of a construction crane in the financial district. Several people are dead. Several others are missing. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Book critic John Leonard has a review of a new novel called The Fur Hat by the Soviet emigre author Vladimir Voinovich. But it wasn't the book Leonard initially set out to tell us about.
I was going to review Astrophobia, a very long and inordinately ambitious new novel by the Russian emigre Sasha Sokolov, in which the 20th century is reimagined as if all the infamous Soviets, Stalin, Trotsky, Beria, Molotov, Brezhnev, and so on, had been Romanov blue bloods, aristocrats in a court of kinky Kremlin sex. I'm not kidding. Astrophobia purports to be the autobiography of one of them, in the style of Herzen, with a nod to Nabokov's Kinboat, King of Zembla, and parodies of everybody from Solzhenitsyn to Saul Bellow. But three things occurred to me. One, it would take longer for me to synopsize Sokolov's novel than it would take you to write one of your own. Two, the real world in Eastern Europe is a lot more interesting. And three, Astrophobia anyway is the sort of book another émigré writer, the humorist Vladimir Voinovich, is always making fun of as too fancy by half. Since Voinovich himself has a new book out, much shorter than Astrophobia, it's easier on all of us for me to review that one instead. The fur hat is simplicity itself. The Moscow Writers Union announces that it will give out fur hats to loyal scribblers, the quality of hat depending on the quality of service to the state. A devoted hack writer named Yefim applies for one of these hats. If not sable or reindeer fawn, muskrat or marmot, at the very least a bunny rabbit. He gets instead a fluffy tomcat. After 11 novels, each with a title like Oiler, Avalanche, or Operation, all of them celebrating heroic proletarians, Yefim is insulted. Never before has he questioned the system. He demands respect. He bites off the finger of a Lenin Peace Prize laureate and a vice president of the World Peace Council. He's accused of terrorism. Until now, nobody seems to have noticed that he's Jewish. After some blackmail and other forms of hanky-panky, the state relents. Fin, feather, or fawn, they ask Yefim, but it's too late. Like Solzhenitsyn's The Oak and the Calf, the fur hat is a wonderful anthropology of the Soviet literary establishment. Sincere hacks, toadies and careerists, burnt-out cases, apparatchiks. Except, of course, that Voinovich mentions anti-Semitism, not something Solzhenitsyn's ever noticed. And Voinovich is funny, which Solzhenitsyn's not. Voinovich is usually compared to Gogol, because he writes short and makes jokes. These jokes about the Red Army and the housing shortage, collective farmers, secret police, and Moscow intellectuals who spend all night discussing the best way to have sex with a chicken got him kicked out of the Soviet Union in 1980. He's always seemed to me more cheerful than Gogol, a sicko, after all, who strangled cats. But the only fiction I know of that the fur hat resembles more than Gogol's The Nose is Melville's Bartleby the Scrivener. Melville was writing about Wall Street instead of Moscow, and that's instructive, too. Not only are their writers like our lawyers, but so are our writers like our lawyers. Therefore, all writers are alike, desperate for approval, capable on rare occasions of surprising dignity. Bartleby, asked to run an errand, declared his independence by saying that he'd prefer not to. Yefim bites a finger. Both have discovered their moral compass. By not trying so hard to write a long-winded masterpiece, Anastrophobia, Voinovich achieves a small and almost perfect gem.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Fur Hat by Vladimir Voinovich. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Novelist and historian Frederick Morton fled Vienna in 1940 after it was annexed by Hitler. On the next Fresh Air, Morton talks about the angry nationalism that incites war. Also, photographer Bert Andrews discusses documenting New York's black social life and black theater since the 1950s. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.